The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Big moves in July for global equities. Apple beats and hits an all-time high. Eating, drinking, and traveling somewhere in Korea. And our guest today, Bitcoin evangelist, Chris DeRose. All this and much more on episode number 574 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey there, it's Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the start of August 2018. I'm a little bit hoarse. I've been doing a lot of podcasts in the last few days, a lot of talking. So forgive me for that. But nonetheless, we did see a nice pickup in stocks around the world, basically. I mean, the whole globe really did very nicely in July. And that was probably one of the best months of the year since, I guess, back to January. And a lot of that is due to the fact that economics and earnings here in the U.S. pretty much overshadowed any of the concerns we saw over a trade war. Even though there was some heightened anxiety and concern over what was happening with the potential for, you know, retaliatory conflicting economic worries and trade issues with China and Europe and Canada. And then we saw a $12.1 billion package that's going to be doled out to the farmers and agricultural sector to offset that by our government. And a lot of these things seem to at least have bounced back and less concerned due to the fact that there's been some talk about that there's some progress in the negotiations. I'm going to reserve my thoughts on that because I don't really think we're there. In fact, just a couple of days ago, President Trump started talking about increasing tariffs on the expected $200 billion worth of goods on China from 10% to 25%. Really, it's kind of like putting the screws to them. Squeezing them. Putting the squeeze on. Anyway, so as you do know, I mentioned I'm going to be traveling. I am traveling right now. You're listening to this on Sunday, Monday, when we first put this out, that I am somewhere in Korea from Seoul to Jeju Island, then heading over to Shanghai, China for a visit and some research. Always doing a little bit of legwork, trying to understand what's going on in those areas. We saw some slowdown in Korea that I do want to, you know, get some of the locals explaining what's going on there, and we'll find out what China thinks about what's happening here with our mini trade war, or our maximum trade war, with China. But as I'm doing so, I want to spend most of my time today with our guests. Before we get to that, I just want to mention that for those of you who have been enjoying our Investology offering, there has been some upgrades, some changes. If you haven't seen that, it's our hybrid robo platform. Basically, we took the best of the robo advice platform and kind of the technology and blended it with more traditional money management. So as we call it, it's advisor crafted and technology enhanced. It gives you the best of both worlds from what I can see. So go over to Investology with an E, Envestology.com. And you can see all about their minimum is $10,000, by the way. You asked for it. You want a lower minimum, so we set that up for you. Pretty well-rounded program, onboarding that you can do. You can check out all the various scenarios depending on your risk. You answer a few questions. What does my portfolio look like? Model it, change it, see what the actual sectors would potentially look like at this time and play around with it. So I really encourage you to do so. With that, I thought, let's just get right down to this because I think this is going to be a really good discussion with our guest. Let's get right to it. Our very special guest today is Chris DeRose, and he's a Bitcoin evangelist, a public speaker, a podcaster, and a journalist. And he's lead organizer of the South Florida Bitcoin Group. And I'll just get through the setup here. I met Chris recently at a startup conference down here in Broward County. I thought it was very interesting. I thought, hey, let's bring him on and see what he's got to say. So, Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew. It's great to be here.
Thanks. So let's just start off with the question I have to ask is, What exactly is a Bitcoin evangelist?
You know, it's a great question. We've never seen these prior to 2000 and I guess 10 or so. It is, I guess, a person who goes around and talks about Bitcoin, answering questions like yours today, and hearing out the concerns of the community and building the bridges between those who have interests in the space.
Now, does that mean that as a Bitcoin evangelist, you have only one position, that rah-rah, sis-kum-bah, you know, Bitcoin up, you know, hooray, hooray?
No, I'm more of like a resource to people who have questions. In fact, I would hope that nobody walks away from this thinking that I am pitching Bitcoin as an investment. It is really my primary focus to tell people what the heck this is. And I'm okay with a notion that Bitcoin is a scam even. I think that's a very reasonable thing to tell people. But at the same time, we have to ask all of ourselves, if it is a scam, well, then why is it that we're having this conversation? And that's the point where I like to build a conversation generally.
So I wonder if back in the day, if you remember back this far, if it was if there was a Beanie Baby excitement bubble going on, that if we would have, you know, Beanie Baby evangelists, I don't know, I'm just saying, I'm not trying to necessarily put you with that, but if we would have had the conversation, if podcasting was hot back then, if in fact there was a bigger way of social media to spread the news, because back then there wasn't really that social media thing going on. It's a lot easier to spread information now. I'm not saying misinformation, I'm just saying information, you know, through social media of all sorts, right?
Absolutely. There actually was a bit of a Beanie Baby evangelist community. I think it was in the Northeast somewhere that actually kicked off the whole thing. And it was a group of women who were collecting these things, and they started a newsletter, and it grew like wildfire, if I'm not mistaken, primarily due to their interests. So there was kind of a thing there. And it may be that this is very similar. I will say that a lot of the Beanie Baby comparisons probably are a little bit inappropriate in a world where Bitcoin has had a decade or so beyond behind its belt.
Right.
It seems. I could be wrong. We don't really know. And we're not at a decade yet. We're very close, but we're not quite there.
So, you know, and I'm not, and by the way, I'm not necessarily comparing it to that. I'm just saying, I'm trying to think of something in the recent past that was as excitable to people as this.
The dot-com bubble is very obviously a comparison. Yeah. If you want to go farther back, I think the South Seas bubble is even more apt in a lot of ways to what we're seeing in the crypto space.
You know, I remember back when the days of the tech bubble, I used to go to various parties with my friends and various functions and charitable events and various black tie affairs and all sorts of things. And I remember very distinctly, there was a time when it was a lot of guys, but a lot of women also were starting to crowd around me and ask me all sorts of questions about just any name you could think of, Webvan or Netscape or whatever you want to look at back then, right? It was like a constant thing, and it reached this ridiculous level that I was being asked on a regular basis about things, and I'm like, what is going on here? I mean, it got crazy, right? From a group that usually wouldn't ask these questions to all of a sudden mini seminars going on at a black tie event, you know? And I said, at that time, I said, you know, something's not right.
Well, I think you answered your question. You were a dot-com evangelist.
And
I think that's what you were.
Oh, I was. There you go. All right. So let's talk about, Bitcoin evangelist. Now, it's kind of like, is talking about Bitcoin like saying, for you, like saying, pass the Band-Aid, which could be a actual adhesive strip. Band-Aid is the name. Does Bitcoin cover more than just Bitcoin? Are you talking about Ethereum, Litecoin, Neo, and all the whole rest of the thousands of coins? Or we're talking specifically about Bitcoin, which you really focus on?
You know, I focus on Bitcoin and Monero and maybe Decred as projects that I find interesting. I think that the vast majority of the offerings out there are just nonsense, frankly. I'm not a big fan of Ethereum. I can tell you why it's succeeded and what its niche is, but I'm personally not a huge fan of it. Litecoin has always kind of been a Me Too project. And really, when you come into this space, what you'll find is that lacking regulation, there's effectively nobody who tells you no to so many outlandish ideas. And what has happened as a result of that is the number of products has just ballooned to a point of incredulity. And so that makes a lot of this conversation a little bit difficult. I'm more than happy to explain almost any product in the space. But for me, I think that the first mover advantage is worth something. I think that engineering outcomes are worth something. And I think that a comprehension of meaningful risk is worth something. So for those reasons, I've focused on a small number of projects that I'd like to talk about more so than the others.
So, you know, you talk about regulation. And it's interesting, just this week, Coinbase announced their first ever hiring of an internal compliance officer. They made a big deal about this whole, did you see the story?
I have seen bits and pieces of it. It's always hard parsing this space, but yes, yeah. I have.
Right. So it's interesting. I find it interesting how they're very excited about hiring this, you know, chief compliance officer. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a second, are you telling me that all this time that people have been trading on your platforms, whether it's GDAX or Coinbase or whatever else they're dealing with, are you telling me there's been no compliance officer? And how would that fly?
Yeah. So regulations are weirder than you think. When you look, when you get into like the cryptocurrency space, you find this sort of mirror where things are equal and opposite. And I don't know why that is. I have some fairly deep philosophical views that we could get into if you'd like about that. But it's very interesting in that you see this alternate dimension of sorts where things are almost emulating our world in full. And then it asks these weird questions like yours, like where is the regulation? In my view, regulation is enforcement. And that explains a lot of things around us. I think prior to cryptocurrency, I thought in my head that the law was the law was the law. And maybe that's true. But now we live in a world where at the conference you and I were at, it was absolutely benign for somebody to have a panel on cannabis industry solutions and regulations. And it harkens right to the very question here, which is, well, what are the regulations? And it seems to me that in 2018, that which is enforced is that which is a regulation, and that which is not enforced is not a regulation. And if you accept that as a principle, all kinds of things kind of trickle down from there, and you can kind of form a little bit more understanding on what's going on. So seeing that there hasn't been any enforcement whatsoever in the space, then the companies offering these products were probably compliant until the time at which enforcements occur. Yeah. And we are now seeing for the first time regulations, which I think is a very good thing. In fact, I think that's what separates us from Beanie Babies. And in response, that's why we see Coinbase hiring for compliance positions.
So, you know, you mentioned something that's this mirror effect, or this is a reverse effect, or this kind of, it's kind of like the Stranger Things of finance, right? Where you have the upside down.
Absolutely.
So when it comes to the excitement over this, though, what I find is that the people that are really hardcore, anything that you say to them, even if you whisper something and just even mention or ask a question, they get all upset and they get freaked out and they just battle you. And they just, what's this? What's the mentality and the psychology behind the incredible amount of emotion that goes into this whole space?
Well, respectfully, you might actually be one of those persons.
Oh.
Albeit on the flip side, and hear me out, you don't seem particularly extreme, to be clear. But it seems to me that you might look at Bitcoin and see a degree of offense, that it is a product which screams to some degree, your values are not my values. This is something that is foreign, perhaps even disgusting. And in the same sort of mirror effect that we've at least introduced here, those people say the same thing about the dollar. Now, I have no problem with the dollar. I love the dollar. Dollar's awesome. I consider myself a person of the dollar. And
you're a person of the dollar. I like that.
Yeah. So I have no shame in that. Neither do you.
Uh-huh.
But these people are the people of Bitcoin, and they take offense to the people of the dollar when they are very much entrenched in that identity. And I would suggest that it makes sense insofar as you are a person of the dollar and you have an equal yet opposite view of them. So if you can just kind of take the absolute value and mirror it, you might understand how they arrived there.
So just to make this clear, just to be very clear with you, so I have no problem with any of this as long as it's not a scam, ripping people off, and people won't lose their shirt with a misunderstanding that it's not something, it is something that is not. That's my biggest concern. And by the way, just to be further clarification, I have no problem with any of it. You want to trade stuff, you want to buy stuff, you want to sell stuff, have at it. As long as there's no you know, bad type of actors involved here, which we're going to get to in a moment because I have some questions about that. But the concern I have is this. I've traded Bitcoin. I've traded NEO. I've traded Monero. I've traded, name whatever you'd like to name. There's a whole bunch of them I've traded, okay? One of the things that really kind of troubled me through the process, and I really stopped trading them, is that, and I actually took most of my money out, took a nice profit out, and I said, okay, let's just see how this plays out. Is that, you know, when I was to transfer money, whether it was Ethereum or it was Litecoin, or there was Bitcoin from one particular place to another. In other words, one wallet to another from a trading platform side. Mm-hmm. I've had major problems in waiting. There was a bunch of times that there was a clear, you know, remember when the South Korean exchanges were trading at like, I don't know, $2,000 per Bitcoin more than it was here and all that, right?
Yep.
There were times that this arbitrage was very apparent and very real. And I said, okay, that looks easy enough. I'll buy some right now. I'll send some over. I'll sell it over there. By the time this whole thing went around, it could have been 4 hours, 3 hours, 8 hours till the whole thing settled out. That doesn't seem like a currency that's usable.
Well, yeah, markets are efficient is a belief that I have. You may not. And when you see the spread, there's almost always a reason for it. Unless you have an inordinate amount of knowledge about these markets, probably you're going to find that that spread is there for good reason. And in terms of like the time component, here's the thing. These are still fairly early days in the technology because the technology is super hard. It is some of the hardest computer science we've ever had. So it is very slow. And the people, there are two types of people roughly who get into this space. The one kind of person is the person who wants to invest in the space. That was who you were. Mm-hmm. The other kind of person is the one who's stuck here. He does not want to be here. The last thing he wants to be doing is blockchaining or using Monero or Bitcoin or any of these things. But he has to because his government requires him to. And so reluctantly and with great patience, that person comes to blockchain because their government tells them he needs to. And he sits there and he endures the hardship that is 10 minutes or 60 minute times in order to transfer money. And those are the people that I think a lot of the investors, if they were to be honest, are the ones that they're investing in, is that market, that commerce, and the engineers who are making those times slower and slower, which is in fact happening.
Are you talking about things like when you say the government's mandate, you're talking about like a Venezuela or Argentina or possibly a Russia or some other place where they're very concerned about the valuation of the currency and the potential, you know, the potential problems they have with government seizing their currencies, basically. Are you saying that is why they're required to be in there, or is there some other reason?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. And certainly there's people who are gambling. There's people who are paying for transactions that they maybe don't want their significant others to look at, or maybe they don't want their countries to look at. You know, I believe in America. I believe that this is the best country on earth and I love its rules. I'm very happy. This is very rare in the blockchain space. I'm very happy to pay my damn taxes because I get so much from the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. However, I have absolutely no allegiance whatsoever to these other governments out there. And I look here on Eastern Fort Lauderdale Coast and I look at all of the buildings that have been paid for by people who are not complying with their own government regulations. They're buying homes so they can store value here and they're remitting payments in these weird ways. And you know, I think, you know what, it's great. All this money's coming into America. And right now it's fairly hard for them to get that value in here. It's working well enough to be clear, but it seems as if blockchain would be an alternative for those people. And while, yes, there are some unscrupulous people in there as well, it would be my hope that as the industry gets better regulated, we can weed those people out. And we're starting to see that. To that end, I would say it is probably an encouraging sign that here in digital gold land, the pirates are here doing pirate things, because that's what gold has done throughout history. It's attracted people in the frontier in a way that, though at times unscrupulous, have also led to civilization and building. And so I've made peace with that, and some people might not. Again, this is part of why this is so risky, because the federal government could just shut this down, and that is a very real possibility.
I mean, this is, you know, one of the things that I have found very interesting is that when there is news about a hack, potential regulation, Bitcoin and the other currencies take a pretty decent nosedive. When there's no news about anything for a while and there's smooth sailing, there's no, you know, there's no sites that were taken down, there's no hacking that goes on, seems that, you know, things are a little bit better or worse, depending on what happens. So it's interesting that, you know, I would think that this, for a while, I thought it was quote unquote digital gold, you know, alternative to a hard asset, alternative to a currency. But then I started thinking about, well, what happens when the lights go out? You know, if you have the bunker mentality, if you're a prepper, a true prepper, is this something that you would be using? Well, I don't know, because how are you going to exchange things unless you have a cold wallet and storage on a drive somewhere, and then you have somebody else, and then how do you spark that up unless you have batteries and maybe using solar? I don't know, but it just seems that still at the end of the day, that hard assets are a better place to, you know, possibly store some of that for that side of the equation, not for everybody, for that side of the equation. And by the way, you should know that my real prepper mentality, not that I have, but if I did have the prepper mentality, I wouldn't buy gold either. My theory has always been tuna fish. You buy tuna fish. You buy tuna fish in oil, not water, in oil. And what
oil,
you do,
huh?
Yeah, oil. This is important. So you're down in the bunker and you gotta, and you're the guy with just pallets of tuna in oil. What happens then? What's so good about that? Well, it's a food source, so you could possibly trade that. You have the oil that could be used for a lot of different things. It may stink, but a lot of different things, maybe refine it a little bit, use it for lighting, use it for heat, etc. And then you have this can, which you can cut up and use as various objects for either eating or for a weapon or for whatever. I think tuna is a much better tradable mechanism than gold. Just a point of reference.
Well, ammo's up there as well.
I'll go with that one.
Yeah. Ammo's great. you look for things that are relatively fungible. They can be used for trade, and certainly ammo can get you meat, or it can provide the security, obviously. I don't believe in gold that much. If someone's listening to this and they do believe in gold, as far as I'm concerned, that this proposition is very, very similar. If you don't believe in gold, then this proposition may not offer you much. And I'm okay with that. But I do think that there's something to be said in society for betting on the belief of Plan B more so than actually intending to be part of Plan B.
Yeah.
And we see that a lot. I mean, the gold certificates market is entirely based on that premise, as far as I can tell, because gold certificates are effectively worthless in a Plan B scenario, but you're betting on those who are around the Plan B scenario in your appreciation of investment.
Yeah, so my world called that hedging.
Right, right, exactly.
Simply hedging. So yeah. Let's skip over to the ICOs for a second here, because everybody has an ICO. There's ICOs all over the place. Seems like, and I think you were talking a little bit about this when you were on the panel that I was listening to, that basically, you know, you have a white paper, you have a website, you have a few people that are from a variety of countries. You have some people from China and India, maybe Russia on your board, or at least a picture of them on this particular website. And everybody goes, you know, it gets really excited about the fact that, wow, I'm going to buy this. And it originally was, I guess, not necessarily anticipated to be this thing which would trade and do crazy numbers and, you know, like go up like it did, you know, thousands of percent. It was just something to be used as a, you know, token of, or at least some kind of a use item inside of what they were doing with their particular package. But ICOs, I think there was a recent study about, like, you know, the potential for ICOs, or some study about how ICOs, so many of them just go kerplunk. And are out of business. I think there's a lot still. I mean, look at Doge Coin. You know that one, right?
Yep.
The guy, what's the story? The guy set it up as a joke, right?
Yep. Jackson Palmer.
Total goof. And the thing went crazy. And then he's like, well, I don't understand what's going on here. So is the ICO market going to stay hot, or is it going to be just much more selective now? Is it going to just go away? I know we have a new type of certificate that's being offered now.
ICOs typify manic behavior and manic market investments in every possible way. People come to Bitcoin, and when they kind of get it, all of a sudden their eyes light up, everything is possible, and they are very quickly removed from comprehension of what they're doing. And people help themselves to their wallet and take the money out and give them in exchange a receipt for what seems to be a donation. And that receipt can be traded amongst others. But it's just a receipt. I rarely or never, there's only like maybe one exception to seeing any of these ICOs do anything.
Right.
And what you start to get into these, again, deep philosophical questions, because like I could envision if an alien came to Earth and they were performing their first transaction and they go to the supermarket and they give somebody a green piece of paper, and then that person gives them back a white and a green piece of paper, the alien wouldn't know which one to keep because they would be otherwise undifferentiable. And so what people come into the space and start to understand is a process of social fact, what it is that humans seem to value with some degree of sanctity over another. And these people are, I think, finding out the hard way that receipts and currency are very different things. And I find it rather amusing, frankly. A lot of people are going to lose their shirt, and that is sad. But at the same time, it's kind of what happens in these manias. I don't think anything can be done about it. And I'm very bearish on these ICOs.
I just want to mention something just to tell my audience something. So there was an ICO that somebody had recommended to me and said, this is a great team. I'm like, okay. They said, look at the white paper, look at the site and all that. So I looked at it and it looked like every other white paper I've seen, you know, with an idea of some sort, and they were going to do something with this money, and they had a team that was an idea. And I'm like, okay. And what they wanted, I said, well, how do you do this? How do you actually go ahead and invest in this ICO? It was a pre-ICO, if you will, right? You know, a process to get the original initial in. And they said, well, you have to pay 2 Ethereum minimum. I said, well, wait a second, Ethereum's moving all over the place. How much do I know? I can buy two Ethereum. That's fine. But I kind of always, my mind goes back to what it's worth in dollars, and it's worth $800. It's worth $1,000. It's worth $400. I said, how does that work? I'm going to give them two Ethereum. Now, I understand if I owned Ethereum and I owned it at, you know, a dollar, that's easy enough. Just give them two Ethereum. Who cares? But if I had to go out and buy Ethereum today and all convert it to this and send it over to them, and then hopefully they're going to send me back some kind of receipt through this weird wallet process, it's a little overwhelming.
Yeah, humans have, there's like this forgotten knowledge that we're rediscovering here online. And it was forgotten because everything worked really well in society. And then when this portal opened up into bizarro land and in sort of the opposite world, all of that knowledge had to be relearned. And so in society, we have these weird things where, like, I don't know, you see, like, let's say a t-shirt, and you and I don't know the word, like, socially adept here. We look at a t-shirt and we take a price. It's like, well, that's a white t-shirt. That's worth about 15, 20 bucks. But then you look at, like, I don't know, a recording artist who does this almost or identically the same thing, but it's like their white shirt. And all of a sudden it's a $100 t-shirt. I've seen this a couple of times now. Mm-hmm. You probably have too.
Yeah.
And so what happens, I think, in society is that people buy into the sanctity of these things for one reason or another. We can call them stupid, or we can dismiss them, but like the effect is real. So when I think on this online world, a movie star, which has happened many times, or recording artist says that their receipts are better than the others, the sort of innocent and idyllic come to them and they pay money for what is effectively a securitization of their like affinity, of their like representation.
Right.
And there's
right.
nothing else to it. It's just that. So I find it, again, kind of amusing. And what's nice about it, I will say, is that it then forces us to say, well, why do certain things have value? Like, why is it that the green piece of paper is worth more than a piece of paper from another company that, you know, isn't green or these types of things? And you're in finance. You see this in the bond markets in various capacities. And you see this in the gift card markets in various capacities. But at the end of the day, it is effectively the faith that people have in their currency that is the backing of the currency. And the dollar, I think, is backed by the faith of people in this word that is America. And the Bitcoin is backed by the faith that people have in this word that is the Bitcoin. And we can talk about that.
And that's because we're told to, we don't know, first of all, you don't have many choices. So it's not like I'm going to, I'm going to South Korea next week. I'm going to get a whole bunch of South Korean currency and I'm bringing it back because I believe in that government better than us. I couldn't do anything with it if I got back here with it anyway. Right. But the other thing is just to mention, just to tack on to what you were talking about with the affinity issue and the appeal to our personal desire to feel a part of something and to attach onto something. I think there's a lot more marketing that goes into some of this. It's the sneaker market is exactly this. You know, you have a sneaker from a company that may be perfect and all, but you put the word Jordan on it, you put whatever you're particularly putting on it, all of a sudden the valuation goes up dramatically because you can identify with that. You have a feeling for that. You're emotionally attached now and invested in that particular name, in that particular situation. I think there's something to be said about that, where if you can get people emotionally involved with all of this, whatever that is. I mean, we're going off track a little bit, but, you know, get people emotionally attached to it, there's a lot more sticking power, a lot more potential for it to have a better valuation than something that nobody really wants to deal with.
Absolutely. And the stock market's not that different.
No,
you look at like Tesla, and I think that's a perfect example of something that has propelled itself on its grace and perhaps its virtue more so than any actual fiscal traction.
Yep. Elon Musk, rah-rah, sis boom bah. So what regulations would actually help the coin market?
Well, the regulations are what make this not a Beanie Baby. And I think that we are starting to see that.
Right.
As regulators and congressmen and the people involved in finance start to serve the people of the Bitcoin, it seems to me that they are going to provide options which increase the liquidity for these assets, that reduce the risk for transacting in these assets, and probably reduce the liabilities for being proximate, or at least socially proximate, to these transactions. And maybe they won't do that. I don't know. But that was almost the near entirety of what you're investing in right now in the space, is what we perceive the regulations to be.
What they're going to be, the hopeful what they're going to be, so that we can have some kind of, There are a lot of companies, you know, I go back and forth with, okay, why are these companies getting involved in it? And I know several different companies that maybe wouldn't have gotten involved in something, but there's so much money. I mean, the amount of money, by the way, he's talking about making Coinbase profits are ridiculous. The spreads that they have, the time-based differentials between buying and selling, whatever they're doing for market making, their particular arbitrage, they're making ridiculous amounts of money. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah.
Ridiculous. Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, there was a company in Japan that had a hack and about $412 million was stolen from this. These are new companies, by the way. The company made good on the $400 million. I think it was a coin check. Was that the one? It's one of these. They were bought recently by another company. But the point is that there's a lot of money to be made in this. And this is because of inefficiencies. That's the whole point of this. But I do think that regulation would be good. I think it would be helpful. I think that, you know, the markets, wherever there's a money to be made, there are bad actors. And, you know, they'll try to fleece you. Listen, you've seen it. Once this Bitcoin came out, the advertisements from people telling you you can make millions of dollars from this following this trading system, which, by the way, what trading system when we're only having, you know, these trading platforms that could do day trading around for like the last year and a half at the time? You know, I mean, it was like, what are you talking about? How could you even do? And most of the trading platforms are terrible. I mean, they're awful.
Well, they're early days, and they're run by children in other cases too.
That's true.
But the adults looked at Bizarro Land, and they just weren't able to understand it. And the millennials seem to like attract to it immediately. The millennials got it because like these are abstraction. A lot of the abstractions we're seeing in the blockchain space are manifestations of real world ideas, albeit made out of bits as opposed to pieces of paper. And I think that the potential here and the reason why these valuations are so high has a lot to do with maybe the funding of online identities, which sounds like it's something maybe that some people may or may not like. I don't know or don't understand. But like you consider that in many ways, particularly with millennials, our online identities are significantly more personal and real than our offline identities. Maybe you work at a convenience store or maybe you work in finance, you wear a suit. But you have to be completely depersonalized in order to do your job, as well we should. But then you go online and these people are playing video games and they're enjoying themselves on various social media outlets. And the manifestation of what is true and real to them happens in these online worlds. And so very quickly online, you have problems relating to people, as we always do, and lacking an infrastructure, a legal infrastructure, a government infrastructure, a monetary infrastructure. We've seen a lot of decay or at least friction in fully developing these online worlds. So lo and behold, blockchain comes in here. And what I think may end up happening is, in fact, a sort of online sovereignty, an online nation, an online identity, and online processes, which sit sort of in a paranational capacity, wherein we have our IRL identities, where we walk around and buy groceries and, pick our noses. And then we have our online identities, which is what we bring into the video games, is what we bring into our,
I'll tell you what it is. It's your alter ego online, which is called an avatar, by the way, which you can then lie entirely about how great your freaking life is and make everybody around you all upset. And then show the best picture, the best side, the best lighting, with a backdrop that's either a green screen or real, by the way, it doesn't matter. But everybody's like, oh man, look at him. He's having the best time. And by the way, let's also agree that a lot of the things that are done are for the picture.
Well, they could also, rather than lie about their IRL identities, they can tell the truth about their online achievements, and they can lead great campaigns to manage the minds of men.
And that's great also. That's great also.
Minecraft things. Yeah, exactly.
And by the way, I'm sucked into this also. My kids demanded that I have an Instagram account, which I didn't have for many years. I'm like, why do I want an Instagram account? I really don't get it. Now, don't think that I'm an old fuddy-duddy. I got the Twitter. I got all the other stuff and all that. But I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do on that. It's not good for my business. And this. They said, Dad, you've been taking pictures of food for like 15 years or more, however long you've had an iPhone and however long you've been doing before that with regular cameras. You've been all the time, every meal, everything we do, you've been documenting all the food in these fine restaurants and places around the world. You go, put it on Instagram, they'll love it. I'm like, okay. So I did that and they seem to like it. But, you know, it's kind of interesting that what I'm doing is through Instagram is I'm trying to find the perfect shot all the time also. Right, I'm trying to find the perfect dish, the perfect lighting. Before my family knows, don't touch the plate until Dad takes a picture. You know what I'm
saying?
That's
great. Yeah.
So, well,
my mother, My mother, you know, she's older than me. She's not.
That's good to hear, by the way. That's very good to hear.
Of course, yeah. And she has a group. She's a single woman, and she has a group. She loves to travel, but it's hard for an older single woman to travel. And she has found herself in a community of strangers online. And with these strangers, she has formed little trust groups, a degree of hierarchy and attestation and so forth. And that now she, when she travels, she has a nice network of people that seem to have been very good to her and whom she in kind treats very well through this online community. And these are people that she never would have met locally that have a lot in common with her and who are rapidly becoming more important to her because of that. You know, if you take pride in traveling, it would seem that you would want to hang out with other travelers, right, but then you're right. Stuck in a local zone with it. So as people are kind of crossing the rift into this online world, I think that a lot of things that had been incredulous to people in the IRL side now become more understandable. And I online, when we look at some of these crazy things and hijinks and capers and weirdness that happens in the blockchain space, it's a manifestation of people crossing that divide. People are realizing that, wait a minute, online can be as personally real to me as offline can be, and perhaps even more so. And then a flood of things happen after that.
Yeah, I mean, in the old days, it was PPL.
PPL, what's that?
See, I love giving. See, you throw some out, I'll throw some out, okay? PPL is a pen pal life. Yeah, you're a pen pal. I just made that up. It's a pen pal. You had pen pals back in the day. You know, you'd have somebody, you didn't know who they were. You write to them, you write back, they'd write back to you. Did you ever hear of pen pals?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I had one when I was little kid, yeah.
So it's kind of like the same thing about your online life, whereas I have plenty of people. My wife's like, hey, you talk about this guy all the time, this guy Frank. I'm like, yeah, Frank and I are really good friends. When's the last time you saw Frank? I'm like, it's probably 2.5 years. Well, you talk to him all the time. He's like one of my best friends. He's a good guy. But you never see him. I'm like, I don't need to see him. My friend John, who I do a podcast for the last 10 years, I've seen him once in my life. But we talk every week on a lot of different topics, and we're good buddies. You know, it's kind of funny. I totally get how that happens. Let's get back to coins for a second. I do have a question about coins, and I don't understand something. Why is it that coins move together?
These assets are highly correlated. These are very immature markets. And in the scheme of things, they're not very liquid still. So for people who are, there's a lot of emulation, because there's no regulation, there's a lot of emulation of traditional markets, and people declare these assets using terminology that they don't understand, making claims that are never tested, and which end up invariably being some weird extension to the first mover advantage, which is one of the reasons why I consider myself a Bitcoin evangelist more so than a cryptocurrency evangelist. And it's worth studying. I think that people are a little bit delusional in their expectations of these products, no doubt. But I also think that like indexing is why. So like a balance to these things is realistic.
Yeah, what I'm saying is if you see a big jolt for some reason, I don't know the reason, whatever the news item is, whatever the reason is of Bitcoin or Ethereum, Litecoin or Bitcoin Cash, especially the big boys, if they move, everything else moves in tandem.
Yeah. So part of that is the
effect. Algos? Is it algos?
Part of it is the fact that the prices are based on the Bitcoin price. So when you, let's say you buy a Decred or an Ethereum, less so Ethereum, but let's say Decred, DCR. When you buy that, its price is on a non-Coinbase exchange, which means that they don't take U.S. dollars. Mm-hmm. So it'll be based off the Bitcoin exchange rate. And if the Bitcoin price then moves, so too does DCR, because it's contingent upon that conversion, that FX risk through Bitcoin in order to even be purchased to begin with. So the algorithm that is calculated on like CoinMarketCap or something oftentimes reflects that process of dollars to Bitcoin to whatever asset.
I got to believe there's still when you have some of these coins that are based in dollars also, because I mean, if Bitcoin moves, so does Bitcoin Cash, so does Litecoin, so does, you know, pick whichever name you want to use. I think there still is some kind of algo also pushing all these up at one time. It's got to be.
That has definitely been true, and that may still be true. Mt. Gox, for example, was a great case of the Bitcoin price appreciating for the entire ecosystem and across all markets as a result of what is probably the activity of the Willy bot, which you could look into. Mm-hmm. The Willy bot still has been totally explained. I actually met with Mark Karpeles in Japan like a year ago, and with cases going on, he couldn't comment. And I would like to know what happened there. But it seemed like there was some kind of bot working that was effectively pilfering Bitcoin by way of attrition on Mt. Gox in a way that probably led to the bankruptcy of Mt. Gox. We don't really know what happened there. And the same thing might be going on right now with Tether.
That's where really I was going. Sure I was going either. Right there. Yeah. That's exactly where I was going. Next question, Tether, some controversy here. Can we talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. I love it.
So yeah, Tether, just to everybody, so what they know is Tether is it's a coin. It's a coin, but it's supposedly tied to the US dollar in terms of valuation. You know, $1 equals one Tether. And it enables a person to buy a coin if it has a cross. So all these are crossed. When you buy a Bitcoin through Coinbase, it's in dollars. When you buy any of the things that are on Coinbase, you can buy it in dollars. On many other exchanges, there is no dollar exchange except for this Tether currency or Tether coin. Mm-hmm. And there's been some really interesting research done recently about the movement of Tether and then the movement of other coins that are attached to it or crossed with it, in that there's something a little suspicious about the moves, right?
There's a lot that's very suspicious about the moves, yes.
So, I mean, and the question of whether or not there is enough backing of Tether to meet the demands, if in fact it was fully liquidated, that's one issue. But what is the big hoopla right now about Tether and the potential for it to be possibly working like that Willy bot that you were talking about?
Yeah, I mean, that has been going back and forth in an ongoing drama, and we really don't know what's up with it. But you surmised like the issue pretty well. Right now, the market cap of Tether is $2.4 billion. Those are obligations of the Bank of Tether. They are roughly analogous to gift certificates. In the same sense that maybe you buy an Amazon gift certificate, you now have a bond from the Bank of Amazon in the amount that is due. Well, that's the same thing here. But Tether isn't necessarily as polished a company as Amazon. And to have liabilities outstanding of $2.4 billion is a little bit extraordinary. And particularly when we don't know where their bank account is. And I don't know that the audits that we've done have been of a world-class sort. And so it's up in the air to whether or not they actually can provide the collateralized debt that is outstanding. So, right, what has happened in this space is people want to arbitrage between the different exchanges. And seeing that dollars take a long time to clear here in this space, one of the ways that we can arbitrage dollars to cryptos is by using these obligations from Tether. However, that creates a strange leverage effect if, in fact, they're fractional, if they can't provide the outstanding obligation. So you kind of have this thing where people are putting dollars into Tether, the obligations are outstanding, and it is then creating this ongoing feedback loop wherein the entire system has systemic risk on the obligations of this presumably small company. We don't know where the heck it is with this $2.4 billion overhead that can't really be explained, which in any other industry would probably be more of a red flag, to be honest. But here in the blockchain space, like this, that's just kind of business as usual around here.
Why doesn't somebody else come out with an alternative to, it would seem easy, an alternative to Tether? Well, I mean, I guess Coinbase did, but there's no one else out there that does that. Why is that?
So it's not actually that easy, because one of two things happens. You effectively declared yourself a bank, which means by one way or another, you are accepting deposits and you are issuing liabilities, which has been denoted in dollars, to be clear, which in the United States is a very like serious endeavor. You need a banking license. If you don't have a banking license, then things get very complicated, and it is incumbent upon your banking institution to cover your liabilities as a customer on those deposits so that if anything goes wrong, they don't bear the regulatory weight. So like if you go to Wells Fargo and you open up a bank account and you put like $2 billion in there and you start issuing, they're going to look at it. They're going to be, wait a minute, this is kind of weird.
And then
they look into your business a little bit and they see all these like movements going around in the crypto space. They'll shut your account down real fast because they're liable. Right. They're liable if you don't cover your debts in many ways. There's a lot of regulatory friction there that I don't fully understand, but that's the gist of it. So these institutions have generally gone offshore, which, you know, is kind of a red flag in most industries. And I don't know where Tether's based. I don't think anybody knows where the hell Tether's based.
Well, the audits are also an issue. I mean, I've seen some of the partial audits and the question about, you know, what do they really use? And is it a real audit company? And are they doing self-audits? And, you know, this goes back to the original discussion about regulation and oversight, which is somewhat, in a way, the antithesis of the coin space from where it started, I believe. But I think it has to be done if we're going to have a lot of money in people's you know, money in it. And if it does have any kind of implications to the rest of the financial system, if it does, then I think there needs to be somebody at least looking over and watching and saying, you know, hey, let's make sure that some crazy things don't happen here. But look, two more questions and I'll let you go here.
Sure.
Real examples that you think that long-term, the crypto coin, a coin, will actually have an impact on in the future, long-term. So for example, I've heard, just get to warm you up here, you know, oh, there's Ethereum coins, which you use, maybe not Ethereum, but a coin based on Ethereum that will allow you to own it and go to a hotel and wave your phone in front of a door and it has a reservation already for you and it knows that you're there, goes to the blockchain, checks it out, does this and all that, and pays and all that, and you open the door and you get in and you're in your hotel room. I'm thinking, okay, I don't know what that's exciting about, but okay, I'll go with it, okay? But other real-world applications for coins, not the blockchain now, for coins that could be really, you know, you see have some legs.
Yeah, so that there's like this blockchain lobotomy effect where like you end up in the space and for reasons unknown, you end up kind of throwing out your general sense because it was anchored to something that got nullified. And so then people say what they told you. But like everybody should be able to consider, even for a moment's notice, that we can do that already with incumbent technology. And yeah, we can
exactly.
do that better.
That's my point.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So the blockchain in many people's comprehensions is like this magical fairy dust. And you put the blockchain on anything and it makes it good. And it does that because I think in the past, people who have taken that approach have ended up with outsized returns for no really good reason other than exuberance. But I think that at its best, what will end up happening in this space is that we will provide liquidity to these markets that are currently underserviced. Paxful is an easy and fun example right now of a company that I like a lot. They provide liquidity between all kinds of assets, gift cards, online. Well, they haven't quite done the online asset thing as much yet, but it's probable that they'll move into that. And I think that the online asset industry will absolutely see a lot of success here. Online assets being things like video games, various forms of outstanding bonds that are in a little bit more legitimate capacity maybe than what we discussed with Tether. And maybe that's rote to some people, but I suspect that that will create commerce in a lot of places that are currently underserved. Don't forget, there was a big cash tradition in the United States that, though unscrupulous at times, was also of a great source of wealth to Americans for all kinds of ways. And as we move online, I think we're finding people are being locked out of certain types of transactions because Amex can't take the liability or the ACH friction is a little bit too high, or maybe people just can't get bank accounts for reasons that are, you know, their credit's bad or something like that. So I think that we'll see a lot of action there. I also think that the governance has a very significant potential in this space. You look at like EOS, what they're doing. I don't know if that'll be successful or not, but I like the general idea. Which is it would be nice for me to engage in, let's say, programming businesses or any idea creation business with, I don't know, China. And I don't want or need or know how to deal with the Chinese government. I just want to do business, but I need somebody to resolve disputes and I need any form of escrow or auditing services, et cetera, et cetera. It would be nice and it is possible that we will see this technology provide those solutions to the online world. So I think that that's a good place. And then the last place that's very cool, it's very weird, but I'll throw it out there because I always like throwing it out there. I do think the art market has a lot to benefit from blockchain as well, which that's a whole other conversation. I don't know if we have time
These
for.
Are all things that are like hidden, that technically are hidden or hard to, they're assets that are hard to exchange. Let's call it that way. Because it's either, you know, it's not like if I have a great piece of art and you want it, it's just a little bit more than just, I could sell it to you, obviously. And I could put it on, on eBay. I could put it on, any Facebook marketplace or wherever it is, you know, Craigslist or whatever it is. But you're saying it would standardize things a little bit.
Well, it's more than that even. I mean, the world is dematerializing. And I think that's fairly evident to most people at this point. And dematerializing in the sense that like, it used to be that you got a DVD and it took up space. It had specie, if you're a Meezen. And the millennials hate specie, like with a passion. They can't stand it. And as we are dematerializing things around us and we are representing them online, we still need all of the same institutions. So I don't see why art would be any different. Art, I think, would be collected online in a dematerialized sense. We are seeing money's been dematerialized for a long time, but again, online assets.
How does art get dematerialized?
Very easily.
Well, you don't have normalized paintings, though.
Well, I mean, you would hang, you know, there's any number of ways. There's a lot of people like right now in the blockchain art markets that are carrying their paintings, their photos, et cetera, on their cell phones. It is probable right. they will hang it on their walls. You'll put a screen up and that's where your artwork would lie. And I don't think there's anything unusual about that.
I do say that there is one thing. Things always turn around and come back, right? So the millennials are all into this kind of heritage type or the distressed type or, you know, the furniture and look of things, right? You go into a place that is a real hip hop millennial place. It looks like a place when I was a kid that looked normal, but it looked like a crappy place. I mean, that was just a crappy right. place. You know, right. and then it's like, okay, that's what it is. Now it's like somebody sold that for a lot of money and nobody changed anything, right? Or for example, we had these Polaroid cameras. You remember Polaroid cameras?
Right? Yep. Yeah. Yep.
So they went away. They were like going out of business with the whole iPhone thing and all that and digital cameras and GoPros and all. And I'm like, okay. My daughter goes, hey, Dad, check this out. I'm like, what do you got? She sends me this picture. I'm like, what is that? I said, that's kind of cool. What do you do? Do like Instagram or Snapchat thing? You put like a frame around it? He goes, no. She says, this is a Polaroid. I'm like, what the hell? Right? She says, it's really hot right now. What we do is we take pictures with our Polaroid camera that they buy for extreme amounts of money, okay? And the film is even more money. I say, well, what do you do with that? She says, well, we take pictures of that and then put it on Instagram. I said, let me get this straight. Let me just understand this. You're taking a picture using a Polaroid and you have the picture in your hand. Yes. And then you take it and you put it on Instagram that you took this picture with the thing. I said, are you kidding me? Are you freaking kidding me? That just seems like ass backward to me.
Humans are neat animals. Like provenance is very strange phenomenon. And yeah, connecting with the past in terms
that's
of
what
the
it is.
Future.
That's right. You just hit it right there. Connecting with the past. That's a big thing these days. And I think it's because our generation kind of let the kids do whatever they wanted. And we we just didn't have the same thing that maybe the previous generations had, where we all stayed home all the time with all the extended family. We're all so separate and disparate in terms of where we are. And I think it's an important thing. All right, it seems that you take me a lot into different directions here. All right, last question. John McAfee. He says, if Bitcoin reaches $1 million by 2020, he's going to eat his own dick on television. Are we with him?
I am not with John McAfee, no. I'm not going to eat my dick, nor am I making prognostications of any sort. You know, it's so weird. People love their fortune tellers. It's just a phenomenon across humanity that will never go away. I'm not a technical analysis guy. Maybe you are. But I see a lot of fortune telling that is done in this world. And seemingly, like all things blockchain, we take this weird mirror image and we look to people in our space that are willing to eat their own dick to, I guess, substantiate the prognostications that they've made. And John McAfee's been the guy to step up and make that offer. And it just adds to the weird. And that's what we're known for.
So let's put it this way, that we have something in common, you and I. We're both going to be, in terms of our prognostications, we're going to stay vegetarian. How's that?
Yes.
Good?
Absolutely. I'm with you.
Good. Chris DeRose, appreciate you being there. You can reach Chris on Twitter at DeRose, DeRose. Where else can people get in touch with you?
On YouTube, Bitcoin Uncensored is my show, and I talk about some very political, blockchain intrigue political stuff, and I would love to have you guys come on and take a listen and join the community and see if you find my brand of blockchain a little bit more reasonable than most or not.
Bitcoin on Center.
Bitcoin Uncensored.
Uncensored. Yeah, I was wondering, I wrote this down. I'm like, what is that? Bitcoin Uncensored on YouTube. All right, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, bud. It's been a wonderful pleasure.
Great. And that is a wrap. Thanks for joining me. We're going to end it right there. Like I said, I just tried to put out something, even though I was away this week, get out something so you have something to listen to. I know how much you enjoy it because I get your emails. And I really appreciate those, by the way. So keep on sending them. You can send them directly to me through the Ask Andrew section of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you have any comments, concerns, questions, things you want to say that are good, if you want to see something that's not so good, all of that is welcome. I really appreciate your feedback immensely. So thanks for joining me, and I'll see you on the other side.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.